Welcome to Casterbus. In this week's show, you're about to embark upon the first of a three-part investigation, a long discussion between myself and James McLean into what happens when Doctor Who's gone. What are the factors affecting the show's development, its potential return, and what happens if Doctor Who doesn't come back? What then on a 21st century landscape, a world that is completely different to the late 80s and early 90s? That's the thread over the next three editions of Casterbus. This chat has been broken up into segments, which you're going to be getting over the following weeks. If you are on our Patreon, the first part of the chat, which comprises the first couple of episodes, if not the first three episodes of this thread, they're all available to listen to now on our Patreon, which has a free trial. If you prefer to have it in episodic format, continue listening through Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. So now it's myself, Christian Corley, and James McLean discussing where Doctor Who eventually goes. We're going to be talking about a strange possibility, a fearful possibility, but before we do that, I want to just say something else about something that I shared on our Patreon a few days ago, which was a video of myself and Brian Terranova. We made a comedy sketch in, and whenever I say I've done something comedy, I always want to like preface it with sort of like, well, that's what we call it. However, it is comedy. It is funny. I've rewatched it and found it to be far more amusing than it was the first time I watched it many years ago, which I think I was very, very critical of it. I know, James, you saw the clip on social media and noted that I looked very young. Yeah, I noticed that as well. I thought it was someone else at first when I first stumbled across it.
How long ago was it, 2008 or something?
We did it in 2009.
2009?
Yeah, so it's 16 years ago.
16 years ago, that is quite old.
Yeah, yeah. So 34, I would have been 30, 33, 34, yeah. Yeah, so it's a while ago. I'm not sure, I haven't seen any photos of Brian recently, so but he was obviously looking a lot younger in that video as well. So if you're interested in seeing that, it's on our Patreon. And we've got a free trial for that, so you can go and sign up to that and have a look at it. It's 10 minutes, nearly.
It's so weird to think that that would be like at the beginning of the new era, you know, where however you feel, whatever side of the political spectrum you're on, politics, the way we talk, the way we understand, the way corporates work, how capitalism works, everything changed about that point. Everything that's, you know, where Facebook started to make its move and Twitter started to grow, and the way that we talk now is very, very different. And it's weird to think back to a time when, you know, Facebook, MySpace were kind of curiosities, and now Facebook's really, I don't know, I don't use it at all. I know you do. Is so redundant. It's kind of redundant still, but its legacy has taken us into new, very, very blurry worlds.
Yeah,
and before that, everything was just a little more defined.
It was. I mean, I do use Facebook, but I don't like use Facebook. I know some people use it extensively. I find that there's some good retro gaming groups on Facebook, and I use Facebook Messenger. And really, that's just forums and like MSN Messenger substitutes, really, isn't it?
I suppose, but in terms of like platforms and sort of community discourse and the sort of and the growth of that across age groups changed massively from like that point. So, you know, maybe young people kind of worked to, you know, were youngish people were kind of doing forums in the 2000s, and they, you know, the people using MSN Messenger, I was in the 2000s, but that whole sort of way that social culture became politicized and weaponized doesn't really start to about 2009 on, again, like I stress again, any side of the aisle, really. You know, it's not, it's the way it's become integrated into society essentially changed, and it's hard to imagine what that was like before that.
Before that, yeah.
I mean, I was reading a post on Instagram yesterday. I'm not going into the details of it. It was a political one, and I was just thinking, my God, you can see two sides here are so firmly entrenched and both totally believing what they are saying. Although I was suspecting maybe 60% of the 70% were possibly AI bots these days, you know, who knows. But it was just weird to think that it was so intractable. There was no, everything is so polarized. And a lot of it has become in that sort of way that we have this, not quite public sphere, because it's not neutral. It's all controlled and managed by money and politics and all sorts of stuff. But a space where people, which didn't really exist before. Mm. And that's kind of weird to me. And to think that video was done in that sort of era where, you know, YouTube was just a sort of place where people posted some stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It's a funny thing with YouTube. I remember when someone told me that it existed and I thought, oh, that sounds quite interesting. And then I found it very difficult to get my head around how to actually upload something. So I didn't bother for about 2 or 3 years after that. And then, but by that time, it felt like it had already taken off. You know, what you mentioned there about AI bots, etc. There's a couple of things. That period, it is kind of like looking, I don't know, maybe looking back to like the 1950s from the 1980s, maybe in some ways, you know, when we look back and see like parents or grandparents with grease in their hair and things like that. It's not quite the same in time as like in a stylistic or fashion kind of way, but it's quite similar in a kind of looking back to see something that's completely different and completely alien to the world around us. I do wonder if that thing that you describe, that whole scenario, that whole situation, that evolution, had its origins in the financial crisis. I think a lot of things that have happened since have had their origins in the financial crisis of 2008. But I wondered, more specifically, that thing about the AI bots thing. And I do wonder if, I mean, I'm pretty certain it does really. It does affect, because they are designed to encourage and drive engagement. But yeah. I think that for people of a certain disposition, maybe not an age or maybe not a social group, but for people of a disposition, it does the opposite and turns people away from social media.
Well, that's what you've kind of got to hope eventually it will. If again, whatever your political position is, if whatever your debate is being essentially fueled or encouraged simply for commercial benefits or, you know, of a company, do you want to sort of step away from that? Do you want to, unless you really feel for that company and you want to be part of its product, fine. But I think a lot of people in there don't particularly, and perhaps aren't aware, or maybe not aware to what extent that sort of thing is going on. And if they're cool with that, that's fine. But if you're not, and you're thinking you're sort of legitimately, but it's hard to say, because I mean, the funny thing about, and this again sounds terrible, about bots which are sort of structured to actually fuel debate by creating sort of very strong talking points or very positions which are going to create reactions. But at the same time, we do know there's a lot of people who carry those opinions, and you wonder, is that because, is the AI bots learning the triggers through those people, or are those people learning triggers through the bots are saying? Because I was seeing a lot of stuff there, and I was thinking, seeing a lot of very similar lines here. And it's either bots or it's people who have either read or there is like a sort of discourse, cultural discourse, which is tapping into very certain key phrases, which perhaps have been read in a newspaper, in an editorial column or on a website, and they're just being regurgitated in almost like a sort of zeitgeisty thing. Or is it just bots saying the same thing they all improve? I don't know. And I think maybe that would be one of the reasons I would like to imagine that we step away a bit from the digital world's social medias, because it becomes meaningless if that's the case and you don't know.
Well, I mean, it's optimistic, but it could just be a fad.
I don't know. I think the only thing we can hope for, as I've said many times before, is that the generation moving up decides to resist its parents and uncles and aunts who are all stuck there arguing on Instagram and Twitter and wherever, and goes, you know, that's just not cool, man.
Yeah.
I'm going out for a breeze. That's what you want, isn't it?
Is that a saying of the future, going everything. Out for a breeze?
Yeah, going out for a breeze. It's, yeah. You're going outside, getting away from it all.
Yeah.
It's going out for a breeze. I'm going to start using that a lot, I think.
I think I'm going to use it as well. And I think everyone listening is going to, because I think it's quite a catchy little term.
Going out for a breeze, mate. I'm not standing here. It's static, isn't it? I need to go out for a breeze.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what we can hope. And maybe then people properly start talking to each other. And then they'll still carry the same polarized positions as we've always had. But I think when you feel there's something out there which is attracting and sort of really pushing down these positions for commercial benefits, you think, do I want to be part of that system? Is that healthy for society? Who knows? But yeah, it's weird to think of that time. And I was just thinking, we'll talk about this, and this fits into maybe what we'll probably eventually get on to talk about today. I was watching the new series of Futurama last night.
Okay.
And just binging a few of them, because they all came on as a block. And I was thinking, this is a fascinating show, because it's now been going for over a quarter of a century or so. You know, I think it was in 1999 it came out.
Turn
of the century.
1999.
And it's always sort of, to some degree, being a parody of not just the future, but of the present and how we, which again, I know The Simpsons and all those do. But with the future, with Futurama being positioned as being far in the future, it's interesting to see how it, over the period of time, interprets those shifts in technology and cultural, cultural conversation, discourses around technology and what we do. And, you know, I was just thinking, I was watching one today, and they were, you know, when one of them was taking a selfie, and I was thinking, I bet in an episode in 2001, no one did that, because selfies weren't happening in 2001. There's sort of minor changes that you can almost track through a show which has been going on so long. You can see where the present that it is futuring has changed as it futures. And that's a really weird thing. And I suppose, to a degree, things like Doctor Who have done that as well, that they are often futuring things which are happening now. But I think Futurama is a really interesting one, because it is meant to parody some of those discourses around environment or politics or technology, which are very present within those pockets of time and very linked to the technologies and thought, the way that we think, that binds them, and then they change. So yeah, that's a funny thing. You know, they did episodes, a few weeks, about dating apps and Tinder or whatever. You think, well, that wasn't there in 2003, 2004. So the longevity of shows, in a way, to actually track how we change as people, I think is sort of interesting. And obviously, as we say, Doctor Who does this. And it kind of, what makes it interesting is that it's not like, and the same for Futurama, it's not like it reboots itself and then starts again. So when you do that, you sort of automatically take in the changes that have happened. I mean, Batman's a great example of this, because, you know, Batman's started in the 40s, my brain says, was it 30, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and each time there's slightly different iterations. But the comics soft reboot themselves occasionally with their, or hard reboot themselves in some ways with time, you know, with Crisis on Infinite Earths or whatever, and it shifts. Or you get new films or shows which situate it kind of within the period that it now sits in. So he will use a technology which exists now. So, you know, Christopher Nolan's Batman will use technology which you wouldn't see in Tim Burton or the Adam West ones, because it's now reflecting a new time.
Yep. But
Doctor Who doesn't do that, because it stays within that same continuity. It doesn't reboot itself in that same way, but it also kind of does, because it has to reflect the changes in our tech to a degree.
There's a kind of a future technology element to Doctor Who as well, because of the time travel. So there's certain things in old episodes, like 70, 60, 70s episodes, where you have like video screens and stuff, which seemed ridiculous then. And now they come, we're doing this now.
Well, there's that one in, I think it's Death to the Daleks, where they go up to the Exelon City and it's got the touch sensitive panels.
Oh, yes.
And you can see, like, Sarah Jane's amazed by this, and so is the Exelon and that sort of thing, which again, and for audiences at the time, that would have seemed sort of slightly high tech. Well, now it'd be something you'd see in a fairground, something you touch and it sort of glows. You go, okay, well, fine. Well, where's the main event?
Yeah.
And it, yeah, obviously Star Trek's famous for it, for its communicators, which at the time were like, you know, a really big deal. These handheld, very small telephonic devices, which we now have, but we don't actually use to talk on anymore because we are messaging or checking things and connected to the World Wide Web. You know, they're more like ORAC from Blake 7 than they are.
Do you think maybe that's why people use their phones like this sometimes? That really irritates the hell out of me, by the way. I just, if you use your phone like this, I just really want to just shout at you, you're doing it wrong, like Harry Hill.
I've heard various conversations about this. Some have suggested that it's come from, it started on television as a way to
actually
sort of,
yeah, going back to Harry Hill, I think there were, when I first saw it, I think it was clips from the Alan Sugar thing,
right? Yes,
The Apprentice, and I think it's on speakerphone, so it can be picked up by the crew. But
so they've got it up, it can be heard by everyone, and then that's become remediated into life.
I saw someone, this is very much for the video version of this, which is on Patreon only, listener, but I have seen someone doing this with their phone before, and it basically, the first thing I thought was, why has that person got an ear horn? before I realised what it was that they were doing, what they had in their hand. Batman was 1939, by the way, November 1939.
39.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Issue 33 of Detective Comics. But just going back to that as well, the old tech thing. I don't think you will have watched this recently, but I have. One of the early episodes of Some Mothers Do Have 'Em, where Frank and Betty stay in Betty's brother, who you never hear of again. Betty's brother's house, which is a smart house. It's a smart home, essentially. And there's all these various things that can go wrong, etc., etc. Now, watching that back in the day, that must have been like, I mean, I remember watching it in the 1980s thing, that's an amazing house. And now, I mean, 90% of the things that are in that house, you can just run off your TV if you have a, you know, if you have like a Samsung TV or a thing from IKEA or whatever, with the lights and the sensors and the temperature stuff and all that stuff and blinds closing, etc. And yeah, that must be, I mean, that was a really high-tech thing at the time, and watching it be so destroyed so easily was very amusing. It's sadly even easier to destroy smart home technology. But there you go.
But it's fascinating you think of things like Back to the Future too, where I've always said a lot of its future predictions were based on the assumption that you'd get hover technology.
Yeah.
But there are other things in there which are doable, but we just don't do, which I think is another interesting space where it's stuff which is not out of the realms of technology, just hasn't taken on. So like the, I think they use a fingerprint for the door to get into the house.
Yeah.
Windows which can show any background rather than just, you know, TVs which are just like multiple screens.
Which we do have.
To some degree.
Yeah.
But we don't do in that sort of way. And I think that is the fascinating thing, is where you get the predictions which are like, yeah, we could do that. We just don't.
The entertainment elements of that, I think, are the things that are closest to what we actually have. Mm. Although I think they came a little bit later, like with the holographic jaw. Was it a shark?
Yeah. The jaws one.
Yeah. Because obviously we have holograms on stage. People go and see ABBA. And whoever, and then you have like you have the drone holograms as well, which I'm not a big fan of for various reasons. I think there's probably, if that I imagine there's going to be a very, very micro version of that developed at some point, because the idea to me of having like 10,000 6-inch drones flying around is just, I mean, the potential for landfill alone is quite concerning. So Back to the Future 2 is a good example of that.
I think that's one of the nice things about when you get a long-running show, which is obviously, like any show, is a commentary on your times, because the audiences are only going to really be reflecting on stuff they know, which is the stuff around them, and yet those times are changing, and so the show changes, but it doesn't, because it stays in the same continuity. And then you have those very interesting production choices, which you see as, say, different in Star Trek to Doctor Who. So like when Doctor Who, by and large, has gone back into its history, it has tried to reflect the aesthetic of its times. So even down to the police box being a different shape or the windows being a different size. But when you look at where Star Trek went more recently, and they sort of, when they did their sort of Discovery and Strange New Worlds, where they try to revamp their 60s with Strange New Worlds, so you get the same sort of very colourful and basic aesthetic qualities. But ultimately, it would be very hard to imagine that as a prequel translating into the, which is going to do by the sounds of it, as a spin-off, the James Kirk 60s era, but now with a 2020s spin on it. And so you're almost suggesting there that this is a TV show and it's not reflecting, you know, the show doesn't have to acknowledge the reflections of its time and its values, and it's, and not just its production values, but its cultural values, which again we saw in the Twice Upon a Doctor with the William Hartnell character being almost like a retrospective joke about 60s values in terms of how he treats his assistants, what he thinks about women. And I don't know, to me that doesn't work. But so I think, yeah, long continuity of shows is really interesting. And again, I've said this many times, I think, but you don't get it much. And you've never had it up until now, not in, outside of oral traditions of storytelling, to have shows which have lasted like 50, 60 years. Yeah. And especially ones like Doctor Who, which have been 50, 60 years of the same continuity, albeit, as you've pointed out before, different production teams creating sort of soft changes. The Davis era is a soft update of the original show, but that is an incredible piece of cultural history, isn't it? And the same with the, say, soaps.
That's the only comparison, really, isn't it, in terms of television? I think
pretty much so, and that's fascinating for the same reason. I suppose the difference there is that for us, and what we're interested in is like kind of looking at the sort of interpretations of future and fantasy and science fiction. Soaps kind of just track where we are, so it's quite easy for Ken Barlow to be a 60s man and also be a 2010s man, if he, you know, because he is part of those periods. But how we envisage, say, like the Daleks, I think that's always interesting as well, like how the Daleks had to change when the 2005s came back, because you've got people who've watched Doctor Who so many times, they're kind of like, well, what about if you just got behind them? They wouldn't be able to shoot you then. And so Russell T Davis goes, oh, what's about if the mid bit spins round and can shoot you? Because now they are familiar with that sort of stuff. So yeah, I think that's an interesting thing when we look at it. And I like Doctor Who for the fact it has always tried to remain and acknowledge that sort of continuity is somehow being part of it, that K-9 looks naff now because K-9 looked naff then.
Yes.
But at least K-9 then was sort of like a cheap R2-D2. That sort of made sense. Well, now if you were to design a dog that looked like that, you go, that's what you created. And I suppose that creates its own consistency through its world, which makes it some way more believable. I don't know. But yeah, the longevity, but we don't have anything like that anymore. That's kind of where we were when we were talking before this. What if Doctor Who died, which is what I'm sure you're going to use as the hook for this. If Doctor Who died, you know, is there anything that would ever do the same again? And I don't know if that could ever really happen.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because you've got baked into it these ideas. I'm not baked into it, maybe added it a little bit later, but you've got the whole thing of time travel. You've got the idea of regeneration, of an alien origin of some sort, and they're fighting monsters. Now we've always had monster fighting story tales. Fairy tale stories, whatever. And we've also always had kind of otherworldly or superhero characters in storytelling as well. So there's all the elements of Doctor Who are really from traditional storytelling anyway. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that a new thing would come into being. But just, I mean, even if it did, and you know, Doctor Who, we have talked about the
you know, the continuity and the reboots and the soft reboots, etc., rather than hard reboots. But you know, you mentioned Batman and all those other things. They're still going, and they don't rely so much on, I mean, there's no, there's a Superman, obviously, but if we stick with Batman, there's no alien element to Batman. It's just this guy who's got some kind of trauma issues. And, you know, other elements in there as well. But, you know, that doesn't rely on the same kind of, that many elements as Doctor Who does it? So, I mean, where do you go with that? Does one say, well, it doesn't matter if it ends or not because something else will come along or not? But if something else comes along and it is like Doctor Who, then why isn't it just Doctor Who?
I suppose my query is there a landscape now where you could manage to sustain something like Doctor Who?
Okay, so that's the end of this part of the conversation. Tune in next week for part two, or head to our Patreon at patreon.com/Casterbris, where you can sign up with a free trial to listen to that entire conversation, its follow-up conversation, and pretty much everything else we've done on Patreon as well. It's all open to you there. Meanwhile, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter on Substack. That's casterbris.substack.com for weekly articles. We'll be back next week for the next part of this conversation. Until then, it's goodbye.